let's begin with a little meditation and to try to both calm our mind and set a good motivation. So if you can sit up erectly, you know, as straight as you can. Relax your body. It's relatively easy, although maybe at sometimes it might seem difficult. And relax the mind. And as an initial part of that, it's just to remind yourself, you don't have to think about anything else right now. You know, even if you have an idea for a new invention or something else, you can attend to it later. Don't multitask. Begin by simply being aware, watching with your mind the breathing. So it's the breathing is known by your, obviously, by your tactile sensation, but your mind immediately gets a mental image of that. And the way that you're watching your breathing is to add a factor of wisdom in there to recognize when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out. So not just simply watching the breathing that's changing from inhalation to exhalation, but actually being aware when you're breathing in and out, you know, the difference between the two. And those endpoints, when it changes direction, try to keep your awareness there also. Because the breathing is more, is seemingly non-existent then, you know, it's very subtle, just changing. You may, may be tempted to jump off into other thoughts at that time, but see if you can watch the moment when it actually changes direction. As you focus on the breathing and let go of other thoughts, your breathing will slowly, over time, become more regular, more subtle. And as it's becoming more subtle, the object that you're watching becomes more subtle. So you have to use more concentration, eliminating other levels of interfering thoughts, improving your concentration, and calming your breathing even more, becoming more subtle. Then with the mind a little bit calmed, follow one inhalation, this time as though it is going through your nostrils to the crown of your head, around the top of your head, down through your throat, to your center of your chest, near the back, near the spine, what we call the heart chakra. Leave your attention there, let go of watching the breathing, and just watch the mind and its contents. If there's some thoughts in your mind, try to see the space between them, or even the space within which they're residing. Intuit that, knowing that there has to be space for that thought to be there. And in so doing, defocus on the thought. You know, take your focus away from the objective object of mind to the its nature, its clear light nature, like space, unobstructing and knowing. So here before, when we were watching the breathing, we were using a wisdom component to remember whether we were breathing out, or to observe whether we were breathing in or out. Now use the wisdom component to again and again bring to mind this quality of the mind as being clear. So different meanings of clear. Clear in the sense of whatever appears to the mind, whatever object rises within the mind, it arises within this clarity. It's not obscured by the mind. also the mind is clear in the sense of being unobstructing, immaterial. Even if the mind is relatively calm, there may still be the apprehension of the sense of your body sitting there cross-legged, seemingly irrefutable. That is appearing to your mental consciousness via your tactile consciousness, just as the tactile consciousness was recognizing the breathing. So you can let go, remind yourself that this appearance of the body is just that, an appearance within the mind, and refocus on the subjective mind that is knowing that presence of the body. Even the sense of I, the observer, as though dualistic, separate from the what it is experiencing, that also is an appearance to the mind, superfluous. The mind itself is knowing. It doesn't need another knower to know it, you know, a self that's experiencing or knowing it. And recall that even the various practitioners of the Buddhist path, the hearers, the solitary realizers, the bodhisattvas, striving for their various goals, all enter the path due to some motivation. So we're going to try to motivate, remember why we're entering into this exercise of listening to the teaching tonight, participating, thinking, meditating, not simply to satisfy some curiosity, although that will function to do that, not simply to find some information for this life alone, to be known as learned or clever, but to heal ourselves. The Buddhist teachings, like medicine, basically, we're listening for two reasons. One is to develop the wisdom and methods to escape from cyclic existence, to really heal ourselves, to become like an arhat, completely calm, chilled out. And as a further motivation, as our mind opens up to the plight of others, we're listening, participating, to try to develop the qualities of empathy and compassion, love for others, and out of motivation, out of that motivation, to set a goal to achieve not simply nirvana, but to achieve enlightenment oneself, to become enlightened, a Buddha. Because that's the only way that we can really help others. Okay, we can help others to a certain degree now, but we don't know the consequences of what we do. We can't lead them effortlessly, without error. And certainly higher beings than us right now, we have no way of leading them, as they already surpass us in qualities. I think I'm going to listen, participate this evening to obtain the knowledge, the wisdom that can help me along this path to achieving, you know, my own healing, my own inner healing, and the ability to not only not harm others, but to benefit them ultimately. Attention back to the present. How are you doing? How was your meditation? Whoever came in after, there's many more people than when we started meditation. You were much more quiet than usual. I don't think it was because I was meditating better. I don't think. More thoughtful walking and very, very quiet. So, let me begin. If you have any questions that are nagging you from before, we've been talking about the subject matter of the ways of knowing. Lorig, that's how this text is called, the ways of knowing. Although the word rik, when we say lo rik, generally in other texts it's spelled slightly differently, and it means, it just talks about knowing, awareness and knowing. But this particular author chose to spell it a little bit differently, so it's kind of like an enumeration of the ways, the types of knowing. Okay. Any questions from last time? You must have, yeah. Nice, loud. Okay. Even though he likes to come up afterwards. Yeah.
When we learn about these two paths, Hinayana and Mahayana paths, to enlightenment, and
so the Hinayana path, not generally, we don't say to enlightenment, although, okay. Right.
When we learn about these stages of the path, and then we go back to the 9-to-5 rat race.
To the what?
To the rat race.
Oh, the 9-to-5 rat race, right.
And then being in a human body, how does knowing this path help us to aspire to it? I get that it has a sense of clarity in knowing it's a roadmap, but at the end of the day, how not to be disillusioned, knowing that it's going to take eons, and knowing that it's going to be beyond me, and how is that going to help me with the 9-to-5 rat race, being a human being?
Hmm. Do you work 9-to-5? Okay, it's sort of like an American. Is that the hours usually here also, 9-to-5? No? What is it here? You say, shouldn't it? 9-to-6, some. Maybe some 8-to-6, 8-to-7. 9-to-5. So, we have no choice. We're in cyclic existence, whether we like it or not. We can try to, we can try to get out of cyclic existence, but while we're here, we have no choice, and we're going to be in it for. If we don't do anything, we're going to be in it for longer than the hypothetical eons you're proposing that it might take to escape. If we were to achieve liberation, it might be quicker. It might be just a couple of lifetimes. If we were to achieve enlightenment, there's a saying the lamas have used sometime. They say it's much better to do the work that can be finished. The 9-to-5 work, or let's say for a guy, every day I have to shave, or maybe I postpone it to the second day, so I look a little bit stubbly the first day. I never end in the needing to shave until I die. Right? That job is never done. Future lifetimes, maybe as a lady I won't have facial hair. Maybe I will. Or as an animal, I may not have to shave. But there's, being as a human, there's a work that's never done. Other kind of things, accumulating wealth this lifetime and the 9-to-5 life. That's never finished. Even this lifetime, unless you get your pension at a certain age, you still have to worry about pinching pennies later. In future lifetimes, you're going to have to start again to accumulate wealth and possessions and so forth. All of these things within this infinite number of lives in the future that lie before us if we don't practice the Dharma, because we will uncontrollably take rebirth again and again. All those kinds of activities never end. That work is never finished. But the work of developing wisdom and the corresponding counterparts of that on the side of what we call method, good heart, love, compassion, understanding how to deal with conventional appearances and so forth, that work can be done. And at a certain point when we're practicing, the realizations that we develop become irreversible. So maybe even in a short time, even though it might take us, if we were to follow the general Bodhisattva path, it might take us many eons to achieve enlightenment, although there are ways of speeding that up with guru devotion and other kinds of practices, also through the practice of secret mantra. Long time it's going to take. But as we begin to progress along the path, it's not as frustrating as it might seem to us right now, because we get a better understanding of where we are. We have more wisdom. We have patience. We have a sense of solidarity with others while we're practicing the path. Like a little child at kindergarten or first grade, a certain state of mind, they might think, I've studied all this stuff until I'm in eighth grade or high school or college. It just seems like an unending. But as you get to the first grade, second grade, you learn more, you have more understanding, and that which you have yet to learn becomes easier. Right now, certain things that we have yet to actualize on the Buddhist path might seem insurmountable, difficult to actualize. But as we progress along the path, it becomes more easy. There's an expression that we have been in cyclic existence from beginningless time. So our delusions, our afflictions, anger, attachment, fear, frustration, all of these things are well practiced. And if we, right now, we can't expect immediately to overcome them. Immediately, we have to. It's like if you have we used to have this kind of paper that you would, big pieces of paper, a little bit thick, that you would draw on, and then you would roll it up, bring home to mom or to store or something. If you were to keep that paper rolled up for a long time, and you'd find it later, say, oh, that's from my fifth grade or fourth grade, you open it up, you try to put it down on the table, it will immediately try to roll up again. It's been habitualized. It's practiced into that shape. So our mind sort of has been, is habitualized, is familiarized with the delusions. So it's going to take some time. But as every time you put it down on the table and again push it down, put some books on the corner, after some time it's flat again. So our minds can be developed. And that kind of confidence comes about through meditation. Well, you might get some intellectual confidence from hearing the philosophical teachings, but we try to put them in the reason that we are practicing these teachings is to put them into practice, to utilize them, at a certain point they might seem abstract and just philosophical, but there's always a way of utilizing them in our own practice. So the way to deal with the 9 to 5 is to try to integrate the Dharma into our life. One of the verses I mentioned earlier, from a very famous 8 verses of Training the Mind teaching. One of the verses is something like this: I will be vigilant of my mind stream throughout all actions, whatever I do. That means during the day, during the 9 to 5, not just during meditation or when you're not confronted with, you might think that the only time you're practicing is when you're sitting in your little meditation room or when you come to the temple or you make offerings or something. But vigilant of my mind stream throughout all actions, whenever afflictions arise, watching my mind stream, so turning our attention inward like we were doing now, watching our mind, and in the interaction with others during the 9 to 5, there will be some affliction, sometimes pride, sometimes low self-esteem, sometimes a little bit of irritation, anger. When delusions arise, endangering myself and others, because our afflictions, when they arise, they endanger ourself because we create negative karma. And we also endanger ourselves because we can burn up the virtuous karma that we've created. Vigil in my mind stream throughout all actions. When delusions arise, endangering myself and others, I will confront and avert them without delay. What that means is our real Dharma practice, the way that we can integrate it into our 9 to 5 life, is to watch our mind. You know, you might think that will make you less. Your productivity in the office, you might get lesser. Instead of 97%, whoever is watching you, they say, oh no, his mind is somewhere else. Her mind is somewhere else. You know, I mean, she's only 78% efficient now. I think you might be more efficient than you were before, but let's say that because you have to spend some of your mental energy, instead of looking at the documents and copying numbers, you're watching your mind also. You don't have to do it every single second. You should come back to it again and again. Watch your mind, especially when you notice something happening in your mind. And when it does, to recall the defects of the afflictions, Because it takes some time to have confidence in that. And usually attachment is the most difficult affliction to feel, to understand the defects of, right? Anger, maybe even for some people, anger is difficult to see the defects of. They think it's good. Got rid of that steam or, you know, that pressure that is building up inside. But attachment may be more difficult. It seems to be your friend. Over time, as you practice the Dharma, you start to see these afflictions as enemies. And you can, since you sense that that's dangerous, you're going to try to get rid of it. You apply antidotes. At first, temporal antidotes. Did we talk about this before? Temporal versus ultimate antidotes to the delusions? Do you know what I mean by that? An antidote, like say if you've ingested some poison, if you've been bitten by some creature, like we saw, it was at the aquarium yesterday, and saw all these poisonous, you know, different kinds of things among the others, less poisonous. If you're bitten or stung by something, you want to take the antidote to that. Is that a terminology you usually use? You can say remedy. If you think of a fever or something else, you want to take the remedy for that. So there are different kinds of remedies or antidotes to the delusions. They're the antidotes that we can apply now that are generally specific to a particular affliction. There's certain antidotes to attachment, certain antidotes to temporal antidotes to anger, temporal antidotes to pride and jealousy and low self-esteem, depression, and so forth. And then there are antidotes that are more universal, that could cover all of them, such as meditating on emptiness and selflessness. It gets rid of fear. And then even in the Vajrayana, you know, meditating on with a blissful mind that realizes emptiness, having practiced in certain ways. So I think that's the first step. So then the 9 to 5 doesn't seem like something different than your Dharma practice. It's a time to practice the Dharma also. And again, the other factor of your question was, you know, this sense of frustration, this, you know, three countless great eons it might take me. But as you're just like putting it in perspective, from the Bodhisattva point of view, once you start to develop these qualities, it doesn't seem so daunting, so, you know, distant, because your mind is more calm, you're not irritated by the other things, and you're motivated out of a sense of companionship, empathy, compassion for other sentient beings. Okay? I may not have answered your question in the way that you would satisfy you, but that's just what comes to my mind right now. Okay. So we've been talking about these, what are called the ways of knowing. Do you remember the list? Do you remember what the ways of knowing are? Can someone, without looking, tell me what the way, how many ways of knowing are enumerated here generally? 6? 8? What did we say? No one wants to. Did you receive a message, a text, how to get the text that we're talking about? Oh, come on. Someone would say yes or no. You did? Yeah. Did you get the text? Did you? How much did it cost? $3 or something like that? Do you know what I'm talking about? Everyone is looking blankly at me. Did you download the text? You. Oh, you got it. So what, did you print it out? Pardon? Oh, that's just the handout? That's just like one sheet? No, but the whole text, the compendium of ways of knowing, you don't have. Did anyone download it? One person? Two people? Okay. Anyway, I think Yen said that she was sending out some blasts to everyone. The text itself that we're using is published by the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives in India. And I think to buy it, it costs, you know, like $16 or $20 or more on Amazon. But if you look in the Amazon Kindle books, it's there for $3. You can download it to your iPad or your Kindle White or Paperwhite or whatever, and you can have it in perpetuum, and you can look at it and up to six different devices. You can have it on your laptop, on your phone, on your tablet. Anyway, okay. So mainly we're talking about seven ways of knowing, and we've begun to talk about a couple of them. Closer, because it's so. The first thing we talked about was correct belief or assumption. Do you remember? Correct belief or presumption is a way of knowing things that generally is how we know things now. We've heard something, and let's say a Dharma subject. We have not investigated it deeply. We may have investigated it partially, but we have not come to a logical understanding of it that's unambiguous and precise. We presume something to be true, like, for instance, the existence of past and future lives, and so forth. Okay, we talked about that earlier. And we talked about inattentive perception, second one. Do you remember inattentive perception? It's technically said to be a consciousness to which some object clearly appears, but is not, the object is not ascertained. That what that means is, say for instance, if I'm watching, I don't know, what do you like to watch in Singapore? You don't want, you're not big soccer fans, football fans? Say an American was watching American football guy, and his wife or girlfriend tells him, dinner's ready, but his eye consciousness is watching the game, and he's completely involved in the game. His mental consciousness is paying attention to the game. Right? Some words appeared, some sound appeared to his ear consciousness, and the ear consciousness, like the surveillance cameras in a building, it. Took that information in, but the mental consciousness was not paying sufficient attention to it, or any attention to it, probably a little attention, was not enough to have to be able to remember what was said. What about on the street? Sometimes during accidents, the police come and ask you whether you saw the license plate or anything about the car that might have hit someone. You know what I'm talking about? Sometimes people can't remember because they weren't paying attention to that, right? They might have seen the car, the license plate, but they weren't paying sufficient attention to remember the numbers. They were their mind was caught up in something else, maybe the horror or the terror of the situation and so forth. So we talked a little bit about inattentive perception, and I'm going to be coming back to these later, but I wanted to try to get through some of the others of the ways of knowing. There's some details about that. The next one in this text is called subsequent cognition. What this means is, from the Sautrantika point of view, when we talk about this logical system that was put up by Dharmakirti and Dignaga, according to those systems, and those texts were talking about the subject of pramana, this Indian word pramana, which can mean valid or prime or main. They took a consciousness to be valid, to be, you know, the most important. One of the attributes of that consciousness would be that it was fresh. Like, say, for instance, we have a train of visual consciousness for a certain number of thought instants. And then the sense becomes dormant for a few moments, and then it may be that you think you're watching completely continuously, but there may be trains of visual consciousness. The first instant of that, like the engine of a train, it's interesting we say train of consciousness, you know, the first instant is fresh, and it's as though by its force, it's pulling the subsequent moments, the subsequent cognition, the subsequent moments that are still knowing the object, realizing, let's say, the visual object, those subsequent moments. So those subsequent moments are not considered to be pramana in this system, although in the highest philosophical system, they are considered to be pramana, that is valid and important, and just as important as the first moment. But according to this philosophical system, one of the systems of the Hinayana, it was called the Sautrantika, it's only the first moment that is pramana, and the second, third, fourth, fifth, whatever number there are in that train of perception, let's say, or of other kinds of minds. Those subsequent ones are not fresh. They do know their object, if the first moment realized knew its object, but they are not considered to be valid or prime. They are called subsequent cognitions. Okay? So I'll read here what it says a little bit. Did we mention last time? We began to talk about subsequent cognition last time? So subsequent cognition is defined as an invalid awareness. That means it's not pramana, it's not prime. By invalid, it doesn't mean, don't get the idea that it's not worthwhile. It does realize its object, but it's not valid in the sense of being fresh, like the first instant of the perception that has some driving force to be able to pull all the rest of the instants, okay? What it says. So subsequent cognition is defined as an invalid awareness which apprehends or realizes that which has already been apprehended or realized. So could you have a subsequent cognition of an inattentive perception? Why not? You're sure. Why not? Pardon? Because the inattentive perception is said to be a a consciousness to which an object appears but is not ascertained. You didn't pay a sufficient attention. So you didn't realize that object. So we can't use this terminology of subsequent cognition. The second, third moment of an inattentive perception is not called a subsequent cognition because the first moment didn't realize the object. Okay? What was the first way of knowing we talked about here in this? This text is a little hard to navigate through. It's just a photocopy from the library. What was the first one? Presumption or correct assumption, right? Does assumption or correct belief, does that realize its object? What do you think? Yeah? What do you think? Should? It, like say, you believe that there are past and future lives. That's called correct belief. If you believe that the moon is made of blue cheese, that's not called a correct belief. Because it's a belief, but it's not correct, right? So correct beliefs have one quality. They're... one has a certain confidence that something is a certain way, which happens to accord with reality. Like, say, for instance, you believe that that past and future lives exist, that karma has efficacy, your actions will have effects, and so forth. Our understanding of these things right now is not through having realized them in a deep way. We just have, we've heard, we sort of played around in our mind certain ways of analyzing it, but we have not yet developed the intellectual apparatus to say that we've realized that. We haven't realized it. It's just a belief. And most of our knowledge is like that now, we mentioned before. That's why our belief, you know, as a Buddhist or as a Catholic or as a Muslim or whatever, are shaky. They're not stable because we haven't realized what we believe in. So the second moment of a correct belief, would that be a subsequent cognition? No, because subsequent cognitions are defined as the succeeding moments, second, third, fourth moments of understandings that have realized their object. The first moment is realized an object, like say a sense perception. You see a color and shape. The succeeding moments of that, where you see the shape and color, You the very first moment you've realized that shape and color. It is not only realized, it is a pramana, it is a valid cognizer, that first instant. The subsequent instants realize the object also, but because it had been realized by the first moment freshly, these subsequent moments are called subsequent cognitions. They're no longer prime cognitions, according to the Sautrantika school. For Prasangika, highest philosophical school, that doesn't matter. They say the word pramana was misapplied by the Sautrantikas and these great logicians to mean fresh. That the real meaning of pramana is that that kind of consciousness realizes its main object, not a fresh object. So even subsequent cognitions, according to the highest philosophical schools, are still, they do realize their object, and they're also called valid or pramana. Okay? There are three types of subsequent cognitions. Mm. There are three types, those that arise in a stream of continuity following from, one, a valid bare perception. So the first moment of the bare perception, let's say sense, sight, ear, hearing, smelling, tasting, tactile. The subsequent moments of that, after that first valid moment, the subsequent moments after a valid inferential understanding, and we'll go into that. That's one of the seven ways of knowing that we'll talk about in more detail later, but we've talked about it a little bit. An inferential understanding or inferential cognizer is a mental consciousness. It's not something that arises in the ears and the nose, and ears and the eyes and so forth. An inferential cognizer is one that uses, first of all, logic to bring about an understanding. Say, for instance, if you see in the distance a structure from which billowing smoke is being emitted, coming out, and you can, maybe it's coming toward you, you can smell it, you know it's smoke, it's not just dust. But you don't see, you can't see through, maybe it's a kind of like a big, what is it, those things, you know, can sort of structure. So you can't see within it, you can't see if there's fire within it, but you can infer, you can logically deduce that there is fire in that location by the sign, by seeing the, you know, the sign of fire, which is smoke. Whenever there is smoke, smoke is only produced by fire, right? Do all fires produce smoke? Do you know? Do you know? Is that an answer? Oh, okay. I'm not sure that was like some secret sign language. Don't ask me. What do you think? Do all fires produce smoke? Generally, fires produce smoke, right? Pardon? Sure. So the Tibetan lamas say that not all fires produce smoke. For instance, when something, fire is defined as that which is hot and burning, its quality is being hot and has the capacity to incinerate or burn things, but it doesn't necessarily have to be burning them at the moment. For instance, those little bars with the wire that you connect to the electricity that heat your little area, you know, those space heaters, one could say that that is fire. In fact, they even call them electric fires sometimes. Unless something falls onto it, it doesn't produce any smoke. If you're a fly and you unfortunately alight on it, there'll be a little puff of smoke right there. But when you talk about cause and effect, the fire is the cause, the smoke is the effect, the result, right? From a result, if there is smoke, you know there is a fire. But the fact that there is a fire, does that mean there will necessarily be that kind of result of smoke? Not necessarily. If there is a sprout, can we say there must have been a seed? Yeah. If there is a seed, can we surmise there will necessarily be a sprout? Why not? Whether there's sunlight, whether there's moisture, or whether a crow or some bird comes and eats that seed. Sometimes when you plant seeds, you have to. I noticed in the botanic garden the other day, someone took me over for a walk through the botanic garden, and I noticed they had a scarecrow. Do you call it that here? Do you know what that is? that's the word they use in America. I don't know if you have crows here. You have? So a scarecrow is something, it looks kind of looks to the bird like it might be a person. Sometimes if the crows are pretty smart, there's certain of the blackbirds that are quite intelligent after a couple hours. They figure it out. And they come down. But that scarecrow keeps the birds away so they don't eat the seeds. So simply having a cause doesn't mean that you will experience the result. Example, creating virtuous karma. It's like a seed in our consciousness, some cause. Will that necessarily bring about a happy result? No, it could be destroyed by anger or something else. Regret. You regret having done that virtuous action. Also, negative actions. You know, you might feel really guilty about having done some, created negative actions this life, and maybe you can surmise you did them in previous lives. So those are like karmic seeds on our consciousness. Those are causes. They don't necessarily have effects. But when you have an effect, there's no way that that effect can arise without having been preceded by its cause. So when there is smoke, there is fire, you know. If it's billowing smoke, so it's continuing, you can say the fire is existing now. Okay. So an inferential cognizer is a way of knowing things in which your mental consciousness has used logic to deduce something. Not only by means of cause and effect, by other kinds of reasonings also, but that's one of the main, you know, very important kind of reasoning. So some traditions do not accept the existence of that kind of knowledge as being valid. They say the only thing you can count on is your senses. Don't we have something like that in our modern world? What do they say? Some expression. You could. I only trust what I see with my own eyes, or something like that. Different expressions. You know. Oh, you're trying to. You know. You're using some kind of verbal stuff to confuse me. You know. I have to see it. I have to experience it before I will believe that it actually exists. So, but from a Buddhist perspective, we can know validly the first instant of that we know something through logic. Oh, there's got to be fire there. That first instant is called an inferential cognizer. The second, third, fourth instance after that, it's a mental understanding, right? Those are called subsequent cognitions. They don't have the, supposedly according to this tenet system, they don't have the force of the first instant. They are within the category of subsequent cognition of inferential cognizers, but they're not called inferential cognizers because only the first instant that's fresh is called an inferential cognizer. And then there are those subsequent cognitions that are neither of the two. There's always a lot of categories like this, but mainly these two. We'll see why. But I'll read a little bit. Both permanent and impermanent phenomena may be known validly. How do we know impermanent phenomena? Through what's the main vehicle that we know them? Through bare perception. Through the eyes, ears, nose, taste, touch. Also, you can know phenomena through the mental bare perception, but you know them through bare perception. Remember, according to this school of thought, impermanent phenomena are said to be real. In fact, they're even called ultimate truths. Generally, in the higher philosophical schools, the changing conventional things that we see are not called ultimate truths. They're called conventional truths. But according to this system, it's just reversed. These things, impermanent things, are called ultimate truths. And the philosophical things that we can know, such as the existence of selflessness of persons and so forth, these are phenomena that are permanent, and they are called conventional truths because you can only talk about them with conventionalities. Exactly the opposite of what is understood by the higher philosophical schools. Are you with me? I'm not sure. Back there. Okay. So, both permanent and impermanent phenomena may be known validly. Impermanent phenomena are known through permanent phenomena are known through inferential understanding. We use logic and inference to understand emptiness and say, for instance, space, what's called uncompounded space. You might think that you see space, but this is not, and this has a name. This is what's called intermediate space. Kind of like you can maybe during the day, the sky changes color, becomes dark blue, light blue, or so forth. You might think that you see space, that it has a color. That's only intermediate space. This is what we can perceive. If I can perceive between my eye and that pillar where the beautiful banner is, I can think, oh, I see the space there. Are you actually seeing the space? No, you kind of have an understand. You see the shape and color that is at some distance out there, and your mental consciousness is surmising that there is no obstruction between here and there because you can see that, right? Yesterday at the aquarium, I was looking at these, you know, the tanks of the fish. And, you know, trying to see if I could see the water. Water was pretty clear. They must filter it pretty well. I mean, most of them. Some of them, there's a little bit dust particles or something in it, or food particles falling down. But when the water's very clear, it's difficult to say that you see the water. If you're on a dock or on land and looking, you can see the surface of the water. You can say you can see the water. But when you're within it trying to see, you don't see it so clearly because it is transparent, right? I gave an example when we talk about the looking at our mind, which has that kind of same transparency, clarity, spaciousness, that our thoughts are some, we can think of them as fish within the aquarium of our mind. Okay? Some of you are taking notes back there, but I don't know if you're... Are you doing crossword puzzle, or are you taking notes? You're taking notes, okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure. Sometimes you seemed like you kept on writing when I had stopped speaking, so I thought you might be doing crossword puzzle or something. So a little bit different. So the fish, the example I give when we talk about the thoughts, a thought can only be present within the spaciousness of the mind if there's space there. So even when you're confronted by, you know, distorted states of mind or ideas or images that are uncomfortable, you can take your attention away from focusing on that object or that distorted state of mind and recognize within that area, that, or within the mind that's knowing that, there is spaciousness. The mind has that clear light nature. With a physical aquarium with a fish, it's a little bit different because where a fish is, that fish has displaced the water, right? So there's no water where the fish is. Whereas there is space where the thought is. In fact, there is space where the fish is also. But if you're just using the analogy as the water like the mind, it's not a perfect analogy to looking at the thoughts. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. Oops. The library, this particular version that they have is photocopied. You can see it's scanned. You can see the bleed through from the back page, and it's not put up as a PDF, so you can't search for words. It's just like pictures, so it's difficult when the application stops, it's hard to find the page again. Although in general impermanent phenomena change from moment to moment, nevertheless, according to the Sautrantika explanation, they still exist objectively from their own individual stance. The objects are said to be objectively existing, different than the higher philosophical schools. Okay? Thus, once you have apprehended or realized a vase, for instance, correctly, you can subsequently do it again. The subsequent moments are realizing the same objective vase according to this system. So they're called subsequent cognitions. Your perception of the vase may last several moments and thus can be said to have an unbroken stream of continuity. Initially, you see it with bare perception as a fresh, non-fraudulent awareness of it. Non-fraudulent here has a very particular meaning. It means it's not mistaken with respect to the main object. Apprehending the vase correctly and decisively, this is a valid way of knowing it, that first moment. As this vase changes moment by moment, moment to moment, so does your cognition of it. You may continue to apprehend it correctly, but normally only the first instant of your doing so is valid. This is because only this initial cognition is a fresh awareness. Okay, so more details about that. But let's go on to the next method, the next way of knowing, or you might say not knowing. So what was the first one we talked about? Presumption. Good. Then inattentive perception, and then this last one, subsequent cognition. Three of this list of seven. Next one here is called wrong consciousness or distorted cognition. So what does that mean? Is that a way of knowing? How can if something is distorted, how can it be said to know? Well, anything that uses your consciousness, the function, remember the defining characteristic of any kind of consciousness is an entity, an impermanent entity, which is clear and knowing. So it knows something, but it can know things incorrectly. You might balk at that. You might say, that's not knowing. You don't know anything. But it is knowing, but it is what's called distorted cognition or wrong cognition, wrong consciousness. Distorted cognition is defined as a way of knowing, it is knowing, that takes its own object incorrectly. So when we talked about the ways of knowing, we had a list at the beginning, the seven ways of knowing. Of those, five of them are not valid. Only two of them were valid. Do you remember what they were, the valid ones? The valid bare perception, the first instant of a bare perception, and a valid inferential cognition, the first instant of a inferential cognizer. Those are the only two that are valid in that they are fresh. So the rest of them are not valid, but they still could know. Some of them know, some of them don't know. Of the five invalid ways of knowing, inattentive perception and subsequent cognition are not necessarily detrimental to your spiritual progress. We talked about inattentive perception and subsequent cognition. In fact, subsequent cognition, second, third, fourth moments of a perception, can actually benefit you. Say, for instance, if you're realizing emptiness, the subsequent moments of that realization benefit you greatly. And inattentive perception is not going to harm you. It's not going to harm you. The inattentive perception may lead... Inattentive perception and subsequent cognition are not necessarily detrimental to your spiritual progress. The former, I guess that means inattentive perception, may lead to a correct and valid cognition, even though you're not aware of it right now. You may turn your attention to that later. And the subsequent cognition may follow a valid way of knowing. For instance, the last moment of your conceptual understanding of selflessness, the last moment of that before you have a bare yogic perception of it, is inattentive. Ah. Oh. You could read the words and you don't want to think about it. It sounds too complicated. So what does this mean? You've used inferential cognition, to logically prove that the self that's appearing to your consciousness, that you believe since beginningless time, and you believed all this life, this particular self, you've believed other selves in other lives when you had different sets of different body, different mind, and so forth, but you've had this kind of apprehension of a self all the time. Even little bugs have a sense of self. If you try to put your finger just to touch them, they'll try to get away. There's a sense identity. We can realize that this self, this atma, that seems to be appearing to our consciousness as permanent and enduring, sort of existing really there, that it doesn't exist the way that it appears. That's what's when we recognize that, when we have an inferential understanding of that through logic, that's the first instant of that is an inferential cognition. The subsequent moments of that, as you've realized that, are called subsequent cognition, and the final moment before you actually say to the individual who is going to develop from that inferential understanding a direct perception of selflessness. Let's say they've already developed deep concentration and the ability to analyze within that concentration, like the fish that can swim within the water without causing ripples on the surface, right? The ability to, within that calm abiding, or we call shamatha, to be able to analyze, which is called penetrative insight, higher insight, or vipassana. If the person is utilizing that state of mind, they've used a logical proof that this self that's appearing to the mind does not exist the way that it appears. The first moment of that inference was a valid way of knowing. The subsequent moments still realize that. But the last moment, before it becomes a mental direct perception of that, the last moment of that inference, because it's sort of like the caboose. Is that a word? You know what a caboose is? Maybe that's an American word. You know, the engine is the first car, and the other cars, what's the last car called on the train? Do you have a name for that? Do you ever go, there's a train that goes from here to Malaysia, right? I've taken that sometime in previous times to go to KL and other places. The first car is called the engine. And I don't know, some of the cars, sometimes there's an engine at the back that's also functioning, pushing, but oftentimes the first car pulls the train, and the very last car is, in America anyway, is called the caboose. I don't know where that comes from. Anyway, take my word for it. Okay, so the caboose, so being the last one, has, and there's nothing following it. It doesn't have to pull something else. So that last moment of a bare perception or of an inferential understanding, that last moment is inattentive. It's just one thought instant, and the mind does not perceive it. You know, it's as though you heard something, and your mind was concentrating on something else. So this is giving a very esoteric explanation here. For instance, the last moment of your conceptual understanding of selflessness, before you have bare yogic perception of it, is inattentive. Yet, that leads directly to this beneficial state of mind that realizes selflessness directly. So the whole point of saying this was that that inattentive perceptions are not harmful. They can actually lead in the subsequent moment to something incredibly beneficial. Your subsequent yogic perception of identityness or selflessness, the subsequent moments after the first moment, although invalid since they're not fresh, nevertheless realize their object. They lead you to full acquaintance with what is true, with this true way in which all things exist. By developing such familiarity with this correct apprehension in meditation, you'll be able, when becoming a Buddha, to have valid, bare perception of it at all times. There are certain kinds of inattentive perceptions. Most people have inattentive perceptions. There's some exceptions. Say, for instance, when you become an Arya being and you have a yogic direct perception of something, that consciousness is so strong and clear that none of the moments of that consciousness, of that yogic direct perception in an Arya being, none of them are inattentive. You know the object. You know every single moment. All of them are attended to. All of them can be recalled. And in the mind stream of a Buddha, every single instant, there's nothing that goes that is inattentive, that the Buddha doesn't perceive freshly. He knows, according to this tenet, he knows every instant freshly. Okay? So unlike these ones that we talked about, inattentive perception and subsequent cognition, distorted cognition is extremely detrimental to your development. Nevertheless, it can have a last instance. If proper opponents or antidotes or remedies are applied, all such cognitions can be destroyed. So all wrong understandings that we have now, you know, selfish thoughts, ways of thinking that develop our attachment or our low self-esteem or our self-pity and so forth, all of those distorted ways of thinking can be eliminated. Like in answer to, I can't remember, is your name Mabel? Mabel, right? Yeah. Mabel was asking, how do we deal with the 9-to-5? So right now, when we apply temporal antidotes to our delusions, we can suppress them by watching our mind throughout the day. And we have to get familiar with the antidotes. We have to read the teachings, hear the teachings, ask other practitioners, how do you deal with various states of mind? We can suppress them so that they don't arise, but to really eliminate them, we need to use the general antidote of emptiness, realizing selflessness and emptiness and so forth. So generally distorted cognitions, you're knowing something, but you're knowing something incorrectly. For instance, you may a distorted cognition might be a mental state of mind. It would be in a conceptual state of mind, not a direct perception. A mental conceptual state of mind that believes incorrectly that certain things that we see in the world are permanent, you know, that rock in the bay or, you know, is permanent, or someone is sinful and they will definitely go to hell. You know, they will never leave hell. Something like that, you know, holding some kind of perception like that. Thinking that some people are just bad from the core and they'll never change. That would be like a distorted cognition. When subdivided, there are both conceptual and non-conceptual distorted cognitions. So conceptual means these kinds of thoughts that we have that are wrong, we hold to them, such as, oh, there's no future lives. From a Buddhist perspective, we say this is wrong, a distorted conception, to believe that there are no past and future lives. That's an example of a distorted or wrong conception, okay? You might say that's not wrong, because you might believe that. But the Buddha would say your belief is a distorted conception. Then there are distorted perceptions, which we could say non-conceptual, both with the mental consciousness or the sense consciousness. The definition of a non-conceptual or perceptual distorted cognition is an awareness that is deceived with respect to the object it takes, which nevertheless appears clearly to it. So the classic example of a distorted conception is grasping to a self of persons. Example of a perceptual distorted cognition is one in which, let's say, a snow mountain, which is actually white, appears to you to be blue. This is an example that comes a lot in the prominent literature, talking about a blue snow mountain. Is a snow mountain blue? Actually, color is white, right? And what cases does it, to what kind of consciousness, let's say an eye consciousness, that it appears blue? Has that ever happened to you, that a snow mountain appeared blue? It did? What was the reason? Of the sky, the blue sky. Maybe that's what is it. I've heard various things. It's something apparently in Tibet that was an example that was used. I don't know if the Indians used that example. They might have. I think also it might be that at high altitudes, when there's less oxygen, there might be other kinds of things. But I think I agree with you. I think one of the reasons is that maybe the because of the clear, say the sky is very, very clear, no clouds, some of the light from the blue sky may be reflected in the mountain. It looks like the mountain is blue, let's say. Or another example is, have you ever had, anyone ever have jaundice here, hepatitis at some point? Do you know what jaundice is? Do you know what jaundice is? You see yellow, or you, listen, you know, you look, if you look at the person's eyes, they look a little bit yellow, right? Even sometimes the skin looks yellow. But in extreme cases, because of that bile in the bloodstream, an abundance of that, when you're looking outside, if you're looking just at a white piece of wall or plaster or something, it appears to be slightly yellow. That would also be a distorted perception. Okay. because of, and there are various kinds of causes of distorted conceptions. So there's a difference between being distorted, and it's a terminology here, a distorted conception and something just being deceived. Say, for instance, all conceptual minds, all conceptual consciousness, what does that mean? Not in the senses, only in the mental consciousness. It's the main way that we know things with the mental consciousness. We think. We conceptualize. We know things via a generic image or a meaning generality, a mental image of something. It's as though you know the actual cup when you think about it. You try to remember it in your mind, or you've heard about President Trump. Has anyone here actually seen in living flesh Donald Trump? I'm not going to shake your hand, don't worry. I'm not going to hurt you either, don't worry. But you may have seen images of him, pictures in the newspaper or on the television, some newsreel, some videotape or something like that, or live speech on television or something. Even though you haven't seen him in real life, you may have a mental image of him. That's a conceptual cognition, a concept. You can think about him. You are knowing the actual Donald Trump, even though he might be doing something right now completely different. He might be sleeping, he might be golfing, doing something else. But you know him via your mental image of him. Even though that mental image may not accord with what he's actually doing right now, you are knowing him, like the example I gave of the little device you have as kids where you put some little transparencies in front of your eyes. You see the Eiffel Tower or the Leaning Tower of Ipoh or something like that. So the mental, these conceptual minds are all are called deceptive, because to that mind it appears that the mental image is the object. You're not actually looking at the mental image. You're looking through the mental image, so to speak, like the transparency. But it seems like that is the actual object. So those, all conceptual minds are said to be deceived because they're deceived with respect to their appearing object. What's appearing to the conceptual mind, is a mental image. Actual Donald Trump or actual Eiffel Tower or whatever you're thinking about, or your actual mom, if you're thinking about your mom, is not appearing to your consciousness directly. The main appearing object, and I say that directly because it, still philosophically you say that your mother or the Eiffel Tower or Donald Trump is appearing, but that's not the main appearing object. The main appearing object is this mental image. So conceptual minds are said to be deceived because they are deceived with respect to their appearing object. All types of conceptual cognition are deceptive in that a mental image is confused with an actual object. The mental image, this, you know, this something within your mind with by which you're knowing something, is confused with the actual object. But even though they're deceived, they are not all mental conceptual minds are distorted, that is wrong. You can still know things correctly with conceptual mind. For instance, inferential cognition. Not only does it know something correctly, it can know something very profound and important correctly. Do you have other non-distorted conceptual minds? Oh yeah, almost most of the things, you know, that we know that are correct, you know the time that the MRT is supposed to come, so you want to get over there. In Singapore, can you go by the time schedule pretty well? I can't remember. No? Oh, you're a skeptic. Who's going to say yes? Anyone? If you have the little schedule, the MRT schedule that says what time the train is supposed to arrive or the bus is supposed to arrive, can you count on that? Ken? Not so much, okay. But not as bad as Italy or India, I think. India sometimes, says it's going to be there at 9 o'clock and it's a day later it arrives or something like that, So not very good at all. Or also in Italy. Some places you can. Switzerland, you look at the thing and it says the train that you just entered into is going to leave at 9:01. It's just going 9, 49 seconds, 50 seconds, 55, 60 seconds. As soon as it gets 9:01, the doors close and the train is off, It's like automated. So you can depend on that. So not all of your conceptual minds are distorted. They are all deceptive in that they're the object that appears, the main object that appears is a mental image that one confuses with the actual object. But they are not all distorted. They can know their objects. You can know a person on the street. You can recognize something. You can know them conceptually, correctly, in a non-distorted way. The appearing object to such a cognition is a mental image. What this mental image is of is known as its conceptualized about object. What this mental image is of, that means, the mental image is, let's say, of Donald Trump, a mental image of Donald Trump. It's the object that you are conceiving. In the case of a non-distorted conceptual cognition, such as one of Tibet, I think the Lama who was teaching this was obviously Tibetan. For instance, the mental picture you have of this land is the appearing object to your consciousness, while Tibet itself is its conceptualized, conceived object. Although your idea of what Tibet is like is not the same as the country itself, nevertheless, Tibet is something validly knowable. Okay? So we talked about, at one point, doubt. It could be called indecisive wavering. We'll talk about that in particular a little bit later. There's said to be three kinds of doubt. A doubt which is, all the three types of doubt all have the same characteristic of not being sure. Maybe it's this way, maybe it's that way. Not completely sure, but there are three varieties. The one that doesn't have any preference, maybe the person exists, the soul, maybe it doesn't. Don't ask me, I don't know. Completely indecisive, this kind of middle. Then there's one that might be thinking, maybe the soul exists, maybe it doesn't, but it probably exists. That's considered to be a distorted cognition. Okay. Even though it's, when we talk about these seven ways of knowing, they can overlap with one another. So that particular kind of mind is not only a doubt, doubting consciousness, which is one of the seven ways of knowing, but it is also a distorted cognition. What about the one that is equally balanced? Maybe the soul exists, maybe it doesn't, I don't know. Maybe that's not distorted because it's not holding on to something incorrectly. Okay. So the next of the seven ways of knowing. So what do we got so far? Go back again so you can review. What was the first one? What was it? Correct belief, right? Correct belief. Presumption or assumption. Then there was inattentive perception, subsequent cognition. And what was this just last one now? Distorted cognition. That's the fourth one. Now we're going to talk about doubt. Indecisive wavering is how this text puts it. Indecisive wavering. Just call it doubt. Makes it more, sounds more sophisticated. Say indecisive wavering. So it's okay. It has a meaning. You know, it's good to. You can use all of these words. Sometimes they may resonate with you more because it's indecisive. It hasn't come to a conclusion, and it's wavering between them. Even the one leaning in the correct direction, say, maybe the person exists, maybe it doesn't, but it probably, maybe it exists. But it's still a maybe in your mind. You haven't reached a conclusion. When you've made a conclusion, maybe the self does not exist, you know, leading to the right conclusion because the self, the soul does not exist. Maybe it does not exist. What would happen when you came to a conclusion? You were no longer wavering, but you concluded the soul did not exist. What would that be called? That's assumption, the first one, the first of the seven ways of knowing. So indecisive wavering or doubt may start out, well, it may be preceded by a wrong understanding, a distorted cognition. Completely convinced that the soul or the self, use that as example, the soul does exist. Yeah, come on. No doubt about it. That would be considered a distorted cognition. Later, when something is introduced to you, some ways of thinking about it, you may develop a doubt because it's been proposed to you that this soul, the Buddha said, doesn't exist the way that it appears. You try to look at it in meditation. So you might initially have, because of been preceded by a distorted cognition that believed the soul did exist, you might first have the doubt or indecisive wavering leaning in the direction of the distorted cognition, which itself is now a doubt, but is also overlaps with distorted cognition, right? Then you have an equally based one, and later, if you follow the teachings for some time, you develop confidence in them, you may have a doubt leaning in the correct direction. Then the next stage after that would be a presumption. So of the three kinds of doubt, leaning in the wrong direction, equally balanced, leaning in the right direction, kind of preceded by distorted conception. And if you were to follow through that progression of overcoming your doubt, once you've become convinced of the correct conclusion, that would be called a correct belief. You haven't realized it yet. You haven't realized that there's no soul, but you believe it. And maybe that's where a lot of us are now in our understanding. We believe past and future lives. We believe in Buddha. We believe we may believe that certain lamas are, you know, emanations of the Buddha and so forth and so on. Those are called correct beliefs. So indecisive wavering... or you could just say doubt. Indecisive wavering is a secondary mental factor. So it's a way of knowing, but it's here, in this text, it says that it's a mental factor, a chetana. Remember I said at the beginning, when you divide mind up in various ways, you could divide mind into primary consciousness and secondary consciousness? Remember? So primary mind is called citta, like bodhicitta. Secondary minds are called cetana. like, for instance, anger, attachment, feeling, discrimination. All of these are examples of what are called mental factors or secondary consciousness, chetana. They, you know, the bare consciousness, whether it be of the senses or of the mind, the chitta or the primary consciousness knows the general perceptual field, just is aware of it. And the mental factors know the details. They're still part of the same consciousness, right? So doubt, this way of knowing, according to this text, is a mental factor. The other ones were more, the other ways of knowing were more general states of mind. So doubt, or indecisive wavering, is a secondary mental factor, a chitana, that wonders about two conclusions concerning its object. There are three varieties. That which is inclined toward the fact, that was the one, let's say, believing that there's no soul, but not believing, but in doubting, inclined to that conclusion. Then the first one, not inclined to the fact, to reality, believing that there is a soul, and that which is evenly balanced between the two. So examples of each in turn are ways of knowing in which you think, could sound be something that changes? What would that be? What kind of doubt is that? You're not certain. You're thinking, could sound be something that changes? What do you think? Is that a doubt leading in the wrong direction? Does sound change? So if you're thinking, maybe it changes, you know, you're not absolutely sure, you haven't reached a correct conclusion, that would be a doubt inclined toward the fact or leaning in the right direction. Second, leaning in the wrong direction would be, could sound be permanent, static? That would be leaning in the wrong direction. You know, and the equal one would be, could sound be either static or changing? Well, that sounds like it's, you're thinking it's both. But the indecisive wavering would be one in which you're thinking, maybe it's permanent, maybe it's impermanent. I don't know. It's beyond me. Okay. So, doubt. There are some who say that that all doubt is a delusion, is an affliction, afflicted state of mind. There are others who differentiate between two kinds, one which is a delusion and one which is not. Doubt which is deluded doubt and one which is non-deluded doubt. It is the later tradition, which believes that there are two kinds of doubt, that is commonly followed. Thus, a doubt inclining toward a correct conclusion is not considered a delusion, not considered an affliction, while those that are inclined toward an incorrect one or evenly balanced are said to be deluded doubt. So this is interesting. When we talked about these three categories, we said of the three categories, one of them was considered to be distorted. Remember? That was inclined toward the wrong conclusion. Here we're talking a little slightly different. See if you can catch this. You following? Paying attention? Trying? So here it's not talking about distorted or not, it's talking about whether they're afflicted, whether they are along with a delusion. So this one, not only the one leaning in the wrong direction is said to be a deluded doubt, but even the one evenly balanced is said to be afflicted. That is, it itself is along with a consciousness which is a delusion. Which delusion is it probably along with? Ignorance. Ignorance is one of the delusions. Do you know the six root delusions? We'll talk about them in the next course that starts next week. Do you know what the six root delusions are? You do. Okay, what are they? Good. Oh, yeah, good. You've got your own microphone there.
Venerable, I try.
Okay.
Attachment, anger.
What was it?
Attachment.
Anger.
Ignorance.
Pride. What was it?
Pride.
Jealousy. Okay.
Okay. Can you help me?
How many are there? Five? There's six, right? One of these is wrong. Oh, I'm not sure. Okay. Sure. What is he thinking of? Sometimes, because you've heard teachings in Tantra or about the skandhas or something, we often put jealousy as one of these root delusions. Jealousy is not one of the six root delusions. What's the one that should be there? Afflicted doubt. And what's the sixth one? Wrong views. So there's five. Before the wrong view, there's five, right? And then the wrong view. Wrong view itself has five varieties. So there are 10 altogether. They said 10 afflicted and views and non-views that are delusions. So usually, so the root delusions, if you start from the there's a good way to say it, but you could start from one way to remember, maybe start from ignorance, which is sort of the basis for all of them. Attachment, the most pervasive. Anger, the most destructive. Pride is one of the root delusions, an inflated state of mind that perceives some of your qualities or your possessions or something, your own being is being superior, an inflated state of mind. Then afflicted doubt. So when we say afflicted doubt, that would exclude what? Doubts leaning in the right direction. Not all doubts are afflicted doubts. Even afflicted doubt is said to be beneficial. I remember one of our teachers, Geshe Nawandarke, used to say, you know, doubt, and quoting Nargajuna, it said in Nargajuna's writings, doubt can be useful if you try to clarify it. If you have doubts right now and you think, I'm not a very good practitioner, George, because I have doubts whether reincarnation exists, whether enlightenment can be achieved, you know, I have all these doubts. It's a natural progression going from wrong ideas to doubts to you know, beliefs to actually making realizations. It's a natural progression, but what you have to do is you have to use your own mind to overcome those doubts. You have to, you know, have to study, meditate, and then those doubts will eventually be eradicated. Okay? So so what do we have now? We're going to go see if we leave imprint of the mind. The list we're having, you can say in many different orders. You don't have to say, but the order that they've been presented was, first was what? No, not the delusions, the ways of knowing. It was presumption, right? Correct belief. Then inattentive perception. Then subsequent cognition. Distorted cognition. We're getting close to the seven. Now, inattentive wavering, indecisive wavering or doubt. It's a fifth. Okay. So what's the next one? In this text, it's called bare perception. Bare perception. So bare perception, we've talked about all along. Bare perception is one of the ways that our sense consciousness know things. Is all of our sense consciousness would fall in that category of bare perception? Well, you might say yes, because there's the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and tactile senses don't have any conceptualization. They don't conceptualize. They don't think about things. Only the mental consciousness thinks. So are all of the senses, what they know, bare perception? Well, we have to see what the definition of bare perception is. See, the ways of knowing that take as their appearing objects objective entities, and even the metaphysical entities like selflessness and so forth, their appearing object, are respectively bare perceptions and conceptual cognitions. Right? Remember we said before, conceptual cognitions know these things that are permanent, and the bare perceptions know things that are impermanent. According to the Sautrantika explanation, that's this school that is the basis for this presentation of Pramana and the Lodrig and so forth. According to Sautrantika explanation, all validly knowable things are either objective or metaphysical. This is his way of saying they're either objects that are impermanent, or they're things that are known by conception. They're metaphysical. They're not actually present as real objects. They're known conceptually. The former objects are impermanent. They arise dependent on being products of causes and circumstances, conditions, and they have the ability to produce an effect. The metaphysical objects that are known by conception can be known by conception. Of course, conception can know impermanent things too, but it can know, the conceptual mind can know these metaphysical things that are permanent, such as selflessness, such as space, such as the lack of something. The absence in this room right now. Is there an elephant in this room? Did anyone have to look around to check? You could. No, I don't smell one. When I was in the aquarium yesterday with Suikim, we were going through one of the. I didn't think it was a very good presentation. The Museum of the Junk. And Suikim, and we were going through this one place, and it just smelled like old rope and everything. Said, "Oh, this smells like the junk." So you would know if there was a junk. You know what a junk is? Is that an Asian word, or is that something taken on from the British? That kind of boats? Used to be used in the textbooks. I'm not sure where. That was what I forgot today. I wanted to look up in the dictionary what the origin of that word is. Because there's a word in English, junk, things you throw away. The junk collector, throw away this stuff, this just junk. But it doesn't seem, it seems like these boats were really big, the junks, so they weren't junk in that sense. So you could tell that there was no elephant in the room because you don't smell hay and elephant manure and so forth. If you looked around, you could see. But do you actually see, is the non-existence of an elephant something you can see with your eye? It is. You actually see the non-existence, or you just don't see an elephant, and therefore you know conceptually the metaphysical non-existence of an elephant in this room. Oh, good. You're thinking. I can see your eyes. Whoa! At first glance, you might say, "Yeah, I see the non-existence of an elephant." But do you? Think about it. Yeah, you don't see an elephant, but that doesn't mean you see the non-existence of the elephant. The non-existence of the elephant is what's called a non-affirming negation. elephant does not exist. Just like when we say there is no self, that's a non-affirming negation. There's no self of phenomena. So that's what's here, the terminology that's being used, metaphysical entity. It's a generally generally characterized phenomena. It's synonymous with permanent things. So it can't be perceived. Permanent things can't be perceived by your sense perceptions or bare perception. Not only sense perceptions, bare perception also exists in the mental consciousness. You can know things barely, nakedly, with your mental consciousness. Objective entities and permanent things exist objectively or substantially from their own individual stance. On the other hand, metaphysical entities, permanent things, do not exist objectively. They're not objects, such as the non-existence of an elephant. You can't see them with your eye. Yet they do exist in as much as they can be known by a conceptual cognition through a mental label. So the objects of bare perception, direct, could also call direct perception. Have you heard that term sometime? Direct perception, knowing something by direct perception, mental direct perception. The objects that direct perception knows, according to the Sautrantika, are only in permanent phenomena. Is that right? Tsukim? Direct perception, even mental direct perception, only knows in permanent phenomena. Right? You don't agree? Someone said no over here. Okay, why not? What can they know that's permanent? Nice and... Pardon? Okay. So she's raising something. What kind of permanent thing can direct perception know? Can my eye see something that's permanent? Pardon? Table. That's impermanent. You see with your eye. Can you see something that's permanent with your eye? No. Although you might say this whole argument about space, you might think you're seeing space, but you're not seeing the metaphysical entity of space. In Indian language, I think it's called akasha. In Tibetan, namka. There's another kind of more general use of the word space. We say there's space between me and you. I see. We think we see the space, but we just surmise that there's space by seeing something there that's, there's no obstruction. If there's something between here and there that blocks it, we can't see there's space there. How about selflessness? Is selflessness an objective entity, impermanent, or is selflessness a metaphysical entity that's permanent? Huh? The second one, which is which? Metaphysical or permanent, right? So that means the mental direct perception cannot know selflessness directly? I don't know, some of you have heard these things before. Some of you, this is completely new, but some of you have heard, so I'm trying to give different levels of questions to different people. So generally, we're taught in the higher schools of Buddhism, like the Prasangika and other schools, that it's possible to have a direct mental perception of emptiness. In this context, that would be called a yogic direct perception. But does the yogic direct perception, so it's a direct perception, a bare perception, and it's conjoined with the union of shamatha, calm abiding, and special insight, is that perceiving selflessness and emptiness directly, according to these tenets, Sautrantika? No. It only perceives things bare perception only perceives objective things which are impermanent. So that's different than the higher tenets. According to the higher tenets, it's possible for the direct perception to perceive selflessness and emptiness directly. But here what happens is this. You perceive the aggregates of your own aggregates, which are changing and impermanent. You perceive them directly, and indirectly you know, therefore indirectly you know there is no permanent self. Remember, permanent things are what we call metaphysical entities, generally characterized phenomena. They're permanent, right? Permanent things like the concept of selflessness is just the lack, like the lack of an elephant is not something you can see with your eyes. You don't know, you can't know directly with the mental consciousness, but you know that you don't see an elephant here. You see no traces of the elephant, and conceptually, intellectually, you know that indirectly, you know that there is, that the elephant is not present. Okay, so we're gonna stop there. We're gonna finish on Thursday with a little more about bare perception, and then we'll talk about inferential cognition in more detail, the seventh way of knowing, and explain this progression from one to the other. So let's because this is a Buddhist course, not just a philosophy course. Let's try to dedicate the virtuous karma that we created, remembering the most important thing at the beginning is the motivation. And during the middle, when you actually are doing an action, to do it precisely with concentration. And at the end, to dedicate the virtuous karma that you've created. Dedication at the end, a little bit different than motivation. Motivation is what creates the sort of general shape of the inertia that gives you the general whether the action you create is going to be virtuous or non-virtuous. Also, the motivation during the action, whether you have delusions or good states of mind, they also affect whether the action is virtuous or non-virtuous. But even more important is the motivating factor, why you got into it, kind of like the inertia. At the end, when you've created that karma, rather than just letting it go and ripen in whatever way it might in the future, like the reins of a horse, you can turn it in the way by strong aspiration, strong wish, or prayer. This particular prayer, kind of prayer, when you're trying to link up this karma that we've created, the karmic seeds, with particular results in the future, that's called dedication. So due to these merits, may I continually, this life and future lives, always find conditions that are conducive to my spiritual practice. In whatever way this karma ripens, may it be the cause of my continued practice of renunciation, understanding of that, developing of that, bodhicitta, the right view of emptiness. Because of these merits, may I practice, be inclined to practice the bodhisattva deeds. May I have the opportunity of encountering secret mantra, the Vajrayana teachings, that allow one to achieve what otherwise in the bodhisattva path might take three countless eons, one could achieve even in one lifetime. Due to these merits, may they culminate in my practice, in my achievement of enlightenment, not just for myself alone, but that I might perfectly, out of compassion for everyone equally, spontaneously and effortlessly work without effort, no worry that you'll get tired. May I perfectly, spontaneously, effortlessly lead sentient beings out of samsara into ultimate enlightenment due to these merits. very much.